You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe, Bill Press. He's host of The Bill Press Show. He's worked in television, radio, and print. He was co-host of CNN's Crossfire and has appeared on MSNBC, Current TV, Free Speech TV, and many radio and print outlets. He's former chairman of the California Democratic Party, and he's the author of several books, including his latest, a political and journalistic memoir called From the Left, A Life in the Crossfire. He will be speaking in Santa Fe on Friday, April 6th at Collected Works Bookstore at 6:30 in the evening. Welcome, Bill Press.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back. Good to be back with you and good to be back in Santa Fe.
Now, you grew up, as you describe, a really kind of wonderful small town America, segregated for sure, a big and loving Catholic family, and you were drawn to public service. In fact, you saw early on the power and the value of politics, which you call a noble profession. What were your early political experiences that got you excited and interested?
Well, a couple of them. My family, first of all, it was a great little town, Delaware City, Delaware, south of Wilmington, on the Delaware River. It is, I shouldn't say it was, a town of 1,200 people. We used to say it was 1,200 at low tide and 900 at high tide because there was a lot of flooding in those days, but probably still is. In that small town, everybody knew everybody else, and everybody kind of helped everybody else. My first political memory is my grandfather was the mayor, the Republican mayor, I might add, of our small town. And my father was Republican mayor of our small town after him. So kind of in the family, maybe in the blood. But I remember riding distinctly. I might have been 6 or 7, riding with my grandfather in his red pickup truck. Dirt streets. We only had one paved street. And somebody waved him over. And this man complained about a pothole in the street that hadn't been fixed. And my grandfather said, right away, I'll take care of that. I'll send somebody over here. We'll take care of that today. And I just remember being struck by, here was somebody who could do something real, you know, to help other people. It impressed me very much, and I saw the hours that he and my father both put in. And then I would flash forward to the really next big event, which was when I was a junior in high school. I was editor of our school paper. The publisher of our school paper was the Democratic chair of Wilmington, Delaware, and he arranged for me and a colleague to interview young Senator John F. Kennedy. This was 1957, the year after he had wowed the nation by running for vice president at the convention, almost made it, and then bowed out. But everybody saw this young, charismatic Democratic senator from Massachusetts, and everybody figured he would be the next Democratic candidate for president. Interviewing Kennedy really, really was a big moment in my life, and there's a picture of my interviewing John F. Kennedy in the book, From the Left, and I remember asking him distinctly, okay, if you're a kid like me and you want to get involved in politics, how do you do it? Well, it's such a big thing, and he said, there's no better way than to find somebody you believe in, walk into campaign headquarters, and volunteer, and you'll find out whether you like it or not, and who knows what could happen. And that's exactly the advice that I followed about 10 years later when I got involved in my first political campaign, which was for Eugene McCarthy for president in San Francisco.
And that was a big start for you. It's also how you met your wife. But in between, you went to seminary mm-hmm. to become a priest. Then you left to spend, you know, to go into politics and political journalism. What did you take with you from your religious education?
Yes, right after high school, I went in the seminary, studied for the priesthood, and I was there 10 years. But for me, the priesthood was really, faith was behind it, of course, but also it was a form of public service. I mean, I saw it as a form of public service. I joined the seminary to study for the priesthood because I saw the great work that priests in our parish and in the high school where I went to did. How much they were respected for it, how much they were loved for it, how much they were kind of put up on a pedestal for it. And so when I left the seminary, having put politics on the shelf for like 10 years, once I got to San Francisco, I took politics off the shelf But like for the same reason I went into the seminary, if you follow, because I saw politics as a form of public service, as really a way of making a contribution, getting things done, and helping other people. And so I took a lot of those lessons that I learned in the seminary about being there for other people and trying to make a better world for other people, but doing it through the political lens rather than the religious lens, if you will. I think that people go into politics and the priesthood for many of the same reasons, I guess, is what I'm saying, which is why I'm not surprised when I meet a lot of people involved in politics today who were former seminarians or former nuns or former ministers. I mean, look at Gene McCarthy and Jerry Brown, two of the people that I worked for, both former seminarians.
Right, right.
Pat Buchanan, I debated on Crossfire, former seminarian.
Well, you wrote a book about how the Republican Party branded itself as the religious party, using abortion and gay rights and things like that as wedge issues. But there's a whole other world of religion and politics. What was it like before that kind of Republican monopolizing of religion? And what do you see now? Like, is that shifting?
Boy, that's worth another whole book. The book was how the Republicans stole Christmas, and then actually in the reprint was how Republicans stole religion. Because I grew up when, think about the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement began in the black churches, right? Not black politics, but the black churches. And then they were joined by Jews and Protestants and Catholics all over the country. Reinhold Niebuhr, the great theologian, social gospel was a very profound and very active, if you will, religious left. And then along comes Ronald Reagan, Jerry Falwell, the moral majority, and they kind of took Christianity and branded it as something on the right, and they've gotten away with it for a long time, so that you almost could not call yourself a Christian unless you identified with anti-abortion, anti-LGBTQ rights, and anti-women's rights, and right down the list. I think that is changing today, because I think the evangelicals have lost their credibility by climbing totally in bed with the Republican Party and with Donald Trump. I mean, I cannot understand how people can call themselves a Christian and evangelical today and accept Donald Trump as their political hero. He is so antithetical to everything that I believe Christianity stands for.
Well, to say that would be to say that that group ever really stood for the things that Christianity stands for in the first place.
True. I don't want to give them too much credit. But, yeah, and it goes back. I mean, Billy Graham, I was sort of offended by all the overwhelmingly positive stories about when he died. I mean, yeah, he was a great leader, but he was the first one with Richard Nixon to really identify with the Republican Party, and also said some horrible anti-Semitic things. And everybody sort of forgot that in the end. I think he's the one who began this whole movement. And his son today is the worst of all, Franklin.
You were in San Francisco in the 1960s. You were there in like Haight-Ashbury, the Summer of Love, all of that. You were active in getting some very important legislation passed in California that protected California rivers and coastline. What was the connection between the political work you were doing? I mean, really hardcore campaigning and lobbying and legislative work, between that and the kind of wild and crazy cultural scene that was there all around you? Did they feed each other?
Well, it was a wild time. I mean, when I left, think of this, right? I'm studying in the seminary for 10 years. I leave the seminary. I did not want to go back to Delaware, that small town. So I came back to the United States and went as far away as I could, which was California, to start a new life, and arrive in San Francisco in the summer of love, right? Talk about a total contrast to where I had been for the previous 10 years. But it was a very yeasty time to be in San Francisco for a couple of reasons. One was because of the whole hippie Haight-Ashbury movement. And I worked right in the middle of that as a volunteer at night. I was teaching high school during the day, volunteering at night in a drug interception center in the Haight-Ashbury to try to help some of these kids get back to their families and get off the drugs. So there was all of that going on. And then the anti-war movement was going on, too, which I was very much in the middle of. So it was an exciting time to be there and to be alive and to be involved in all of that. And at the same time, I mentioned, I got involved in the McCarthy for President campaign, which was also very much a part of the anti-war movement. And through that, I really decided that I wanted to make politics my calling, if you will, my profession, my next vocation. And I was very lucky to hook up with a Republican who was running for the state Senate in Marin County, right across the Golden Gate Bridge. I ran his campaign, and he was a leading environmentalist. So through him, I really became part of the early environmental movement. He spoke at the very first Earth Day in San Francisco. And through him, his name was Peter Baer, I got involved in the great campaign to save the California coast. It was a citizens initiative fought by all the developers and all the oil companies and everybody, and we won that battle. And his very first piece of legislation, which I helped him write once he was elected to the state Senate, was to save the last three free-flowing rivers in California, rivers that had not been dammed, already dammed, were flowing from the mountains to the sea. And he got that legislation through the Assembly and the Senate and signed into law by Governor Ronald Reagan at the time. So it was a progression from, again, seminary to politics to environmental politics. And that's not such a big leap either, because I really believe that if you read the book of Genesis, the book of Genesis tells us about this wonderful creation that we are part of and that we have a duty of stewardship to take care of. So I think the environmental movement has some very basic biblical and Christian roots.
Well, you also say in your book that Jesus was a liberal.
I believe so. I mean, look who he hung out with and look what he talked about. The great Tim Russert, host of Meet the Press, once called me a Sermon on the Mount Catholic, and I wear that as a badge of honor.
You were involved in politics in California. You ran for insurance commissioner there. You ran for Senate. You were chairman of the Democratic Party in California. You also were doing journalism. You were doing radio and TV. And I mean, we're compressing a lot of time here, but at a certain point, you had to make a decision between politics and journalism. What happened and how did you make that decision?
Well, first of all, I'd been through my political career with Peter Baer, running for the state Senate. I was his chief of staff for a couple of years. I headed up an environmental organization, thanks to him, a statewide environmental organization. I was their lobbyist in Sacramento. And then I met Jerry Brown when he was just elected governor, went to work for Jerry Brown for 4 years, doing environmental policy and politics for the governor, also working in his presidential campaigns. And by that time, I kind of wanted to do something on my own. And I was always interested in talking about ideas and writing about ideas. And so I decided I would like to attempt to get involved in the media, in radio and television. And without ever going to journalism school or whatever, I was very lucky. I got a job on the number one television station in the state, in Los Angeles, KABC-TV. And I was there, took some time out to run for office, as you mentioned, did not succeed, came back to television, was working on television until I then got an offer to come back to Washington, D.C. and be co-host of Crossfire on CNN. That's when I get to the point that you're mentioning is I had been at. So here I am on national television, having been in California doing local radio and TV and being chair of the Democratic Party. I resigned that position to take the job at Crossfire. And I'd been at CNN maybe 6 months when I got a call from Vice President Al Gore, the Democratic National Chairman at the time. Senator Chris Dodd was retiring or resigning. And the Vice President said he wanted to recommend me as the next chair of the Democratic Party, National Party. And so here I'm torn. Then I really, for the rest of my life, I knew it was either going to be all politics or all media. And I called my conservative co-host at the time, Bob Novak, whom we all called the Prince of Darkness. He I remember he told me, Bill, you've got to decide what you want to be when you grow up. And so we talked about the possibilities, and I just decided that if I were national chair, then I would be a political hack for the rest of my life. And I really had a great job in the media. I was getting paid for it. I liked it. I thought I could have more influence talking about those issues on radio and television every day on a national level than I could even as a member of Congress. And so I made the decision to stick with the media. And I'm glad I did.
Many others are too.
Thank you.
You wrote that if you're going to go into journalism, you have to be ready to piss people off. You have to have a very thick skin, the skin of an armadillo, I think you wrote. And there's this interesting quote that you quote from Howard Stern. People who love my show listen to it for half an hour. People who hate it listen to it for 2 hours. There are people who love to hate. I'm not one of those people, but there are a lot of them out there. That's the media environment now. How do you understand that?
Well, yeah, I'm not a hater either. You know me. I was proud when I was doing that job as an environmental lobbyist in Sacramento that I was actually voted one of the 10 most popular lobbyists in Sacramento. What they said about me, I remember it was the California Journal, was, he can disagree without being disagreeable.
Right.
I think that's very important. But I also learned about this hate fix in the media. In my first job in television at KABC in Los Angeles, so my job was, I was a political commentator. I gave a 2.5 minute commentary every night on the 5 o'clock news. And the phones would just go crazy when I finished. People saying, I'll never watch again. You've got to fire him. You know, ugly, ugly things about me. I couldn't believe it. You know, I'll never watch again. And the next day, the same number of calls, if not more, by people saying, I'll never watch again. Right. And I realized that some of these people were tuning in just to get their hate fix every day, which I still find pretty bizarre. The way I deal with it is I just say what I think. I have a thick skin. And people can agree or disagree with me, but I figure if I've got the microphone, if I have the opportunity, I'm going to use it to, number one, say what I think, and number two, try to use it to, like I said, I went in the seminary for the same reason, I went in politics for the same reason, to try to make this a better world for people today and for our kids and grandkids in every way that I can and support the causes that we all believe in. I believe that's the responsibility that comes with the microphone.
Well, it's so interesting to be working with the debate format. That's what you did on Crossfire. You had conservative co-hosts like Pat Buchanan and others, and you took the kind of liberal perspective. Another person took the conservative perspective. Everybody was very well prepared and very well armed. And I find myself wondering with the debate format, I mean, it has a lot of value when people are good speakers and when the issue really does have two viable sides. Now, that's not always the case. But, I mean, we just talked about people who love to hate. Did you find that there were people who really changed their minds when presented with the facts in a debate, or did they just become more entrenched?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, I got to say about the debate, the thing that was great about, I debated in high school on the team. I coached debate in high school when I was a teacher. I debated in college. I liked the debate format. And the one thing that I learned, I talk about this in the book too, is coming out of the academic debate, if you will, before Crossfire and the media debate, but after the academic debate is, you know, as high school students, we had a topic. It might've been the death penalty or whatever. But you had to be able to debate. You had to know both sides and be able to debate both sides.
Right.
And that was very important training because you had to really understand the arguments of the other side and listen to the arguments of the other side and respond to those arguments. So I'm not saying it was all an academic exercise. I certainly had strong beliefs, right? But I had to really understand both sides of an issue. And I took that to Crossfire. And I think the strength of that program, which I say, and I still believe, is the first and the best of the political debate shows ever, and that CNN made a big mistake in canceling the original Crossfire, is that the show was on one topic for a half an hour with two hosts who knew enough to ask some good questions, and then two experts who really know the inside and the outside of those issues. And the one rule that we had was, you know, we were passionate, I was, about my beliefs on the left. Pat Buchanan, Bob Novak, Mary Madeline, Tucker Carlson, they were passionate about their beliefs on the right. And we debated those strongly and fiercely on the program. But when it was over, we didn't internalize that and make it personal and walk away with any hard feelings about each other. We actually liked each other, right? You know, and I remember John Sununu, who was a co-host for some period when Pat Buchanan was off running for president. John Sununu once said, you know, look, the show is too short and life is too short to take this personally, you know? And we've lost that today. There are too many people who don't take the time to try to understand the other point of view or don't take the time to listen or to learn. Now, directly to your question, absolutely. I can tell you, for example, I remember with Pat Buchanan at one time, he was fiercely opposed to medical marijuana. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I thought it was cruel. But Pat's turned around on that issue. I remember one time Pat was fiercely opposed to any trade with Cuba. The old, you know, not until Castro dies will we even allow any Americans to go down there, whatever. And Pat turned around on that as well. And I can tell you one that I turned around on is I was kind of a hawkish Democrat growing up. I actually wrote a letter in support of the war in Vietnam to Lyndon Johnson, you know, and I'm ashamed of that today, but I was part of that generation. And I learned a lot from Bob Novak and Pat Buchanan about how we, the United States, were too ready to use our military might in places where we didn't belong. That led up to my opposition to the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. But I learned it from them.
What about your listeners? Do you have any evidence that listeners were also changing their minds? I should say listeners and viewers.
Occasionally. Many people over the years have written to me and said, you really helped me out, right? I really understood the issues, thanks to you. But okay. I don't know of any dramatic conversion, right, because of something they heard me say. But I do think the one thing I always felt about, I go back to Crossfire and the other shows that I've done, is that a show like that, at the end of it, if people understand the issue better, they can come to an informed decision of their own. You know, I'm not out there to convert millions of people, right? I just want to explain the issues as I see them and make the case for what I believe is the right side of that issue as forcefully as I can.
Right.
And hopefully some people will agree.
One of the things you write about was that you covered the Monica Lewinsky scandal weeks and weeks. And at a certain point, you were like, you know, we've done every possible angle on this. So you took a break, did a show on NATO. The show didn't get good ratings. You went straight back to Monica Lewinsky. And I'm listening to this. I'm thinking, you know, during that time, I mean, there was not only NATO, there were trade issues, environmental issues, race issues. None of that was covered. How did you feel at that point? And how do you feel now about doing, I mean, essentially you were doing shows for ratings. You were covering sex scandals instead of issues of substance.
Yeah. And you know what? It's gotten worse since. No, I hate it. I hate it. I must admit, today I have a lot more freedom because I have my own show and I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. And I do try to stick to the important issues and not get drawn off into all of this glitz and glamour and sex scandals. But it was very frustrating to me and to Pat and the rest of us when we were so ratings driven, even on a show like Crossfire. In that particular case, Pat and I both had just had it. And we argued, Pat came up with the idea of NATO expansion, which, by the way, it's funny, but it was an important issue then. It's still an important issue today.
Exactly.
With Vladimir Putin and what's happening in the Ukraine and the Baltics, it's very much alive today. Nobody's talking about it today, but it's still unresolved and it's still carry on. So we said we're going to argue that, and we did. The ratings sunk, and the next day we were told, in no uncertain terms, we're going to go back to Monica Lewinsky and stick there. But that's the problem with cable news, is that it's 24/7, right? A new thing pops up. And you know, it's gotten worse since Trump got in the White House because he does and says all this crazy stuff. So you're on 24/7 on Stormy Daniels. And the next day you're 24/7 on Karen McDougal. And the next day you're, you know, 24/7 on Donald Trump, whatever he says about the Dreamers or the next day 24/7 what he says about Elizabeth Warren or Nancy Pelosi. And a lot of, too many of the really, really fundamental important issues, like what Donald Trump might be doing in terms of building new nuclear weapons, like what Donald Trump might be doing to undo every bit of progress that Barack Obama made toward climate change, dealing with climate change, none of that gets talked about, and we focus on these, you know, ratings bombshells. I think in many ways, cable news has ruined American politics.
There's a number of things that have ruined American politics, and cable news, you certainly can make an argument for that. Another thing that you witnessed was the transition from the period when Democrats and Republicans talked to each other and hammered out deals to the current situation of enmity and contempt for compromise, which, as you, I think, accurately point out, is really from the Republican side. I mean, it's not true of the Democrats. If anything, and you write about this at some length, Obama compromised too much. What happened to create that situation of no longer having the so-called loyal opposition, but to having this party of no and lack of compromise and the profound dysfunction that came from that? And what do you think can be done to fix it?
Well, first of all, here's my theory, and I've heard several members of or former members of Congress expound the same theory. I put it on the shoulders of one man, and that's Newt Gingrich. It wasn't that long ago, and I saw this in Sacramento. That's the way it operated when Ronald Reagan was governor, when Jerry Brown was governor. I saw it here in Washington when I first got here. It wasn't that long ago when members, leaders of the two parties, during the election year, they'd fight like hell to get their people elected, to get control or whatever. But once the election was over, it was time out. It was time for not campaigning. It was time for governing. And you take people like Bob Dole, George Mitchell, Tom Daschle, or Trent Lott, and what they would do is they would sit down and say, okay, you won, I lost, or whatever. Now, what are the problems we got to deal with, and how are we going to deal with them? And everybody knew going into that you weren't going to get everything you wanted, but they identified the problems and they started working together to resolve those problems. That doesn't happen anymore, and it ended with Newt Gingrich. When he became Speaker, he said, no more of this reaching across the aisle. We don't want to deal with the Democrats. He actually issued a list of words that Republicans should use when they were talking about Republicans, and a list of words they should use when they're talking about Democrats. Of course, all the words on the Democratic list were negative, lazy, ignorant, unpatriotic, and all the words on the Republican list were like loyalty and courage and
flag.
Yeah, flag, exactly. And sadly, that Gingrich attitude still prevails today among the Republican Party. Now, as I point out, Democrats are always willing to make a deal. Look at Chuck Schumer and Nancy today. They get criticized for ready to make a deal with Donald Trump on some issues. They did on the budget the first time around. I thought it was a good deal on their part. But there are too many Republicans, particularly in the so-called Freedom Caucus, which we used to call the Tea Party, who, first of all, they come to Washington not to get anything done, but to tear down. And they're not willing to work together on any issues. They will even oppose things that they might have once stood for if Barack Obama were for it or for Democrats were for it.
Right.
Immigration reform, for example. There was comprehensive immigration reform that George Bush put forward, which I supported. I thought was a good program. They shot it down. Barack Obama came. Some of them supported it. They're the ones I'm talking about. And Barack Obama came up with basically the same program, and Republicans opposed it because it had his name on it. The individual mandate, part of the core of Obamacare, came out of the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank in Washington, which they were all for when Mitt Romney used it in Massachusetts. Barack Obama put it in the Affordable Care Act. They opposed it because they had Barack Obama's name on it. So the answer is, I think you got to get rid of these people. You got to get rid of these people and get some people in on both sides who are there to solve problems and get things done. I don't mean to go on and on here to filibuster, but just real quickly, about a month ago, I moderated a panel on this very topic at George Washington University. They asked me to do it, and I said, okay, I'll do it. But I went to Tom Daschle and Trent Lott, both of whom agreed to be on the panel. They were the panelists. It was excellent. And the two of them just pointed out, they both of them are dismayed and embarrassed and saddened by the level of hostility today and the unwillingness of people to work together and solve problems. So we got to go back and get people like that in and get people like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell out.
You've worked in TV and radio and print. You've seen presidents come and go. You've seen journalism change. I mean, you were talking about the force, not for the good, of cable network news. One of the things that you wrote about was how under George W. Bush, journalists were weirdly compliant. They kind of wrote down what the press people said, what the administration said, didn't challenge their word, didn't do the investigation. Then under Obama, that changed. They went after everything. What's going on? How do you understand it? Are journalists harder on Democrats than on Republicans?
I think they can be. And my experience has been certainly with Obama and with Bush, they were pussycats under George Bush. I was not covering the White House at the time, but I certainly was watching the briefings and reporting on the briefings and the administration policy. But all that stuff about Saddam Hussein building nuclear weapons, they had these mobile trailers or whatever, you know, they could move the missiles around. All that stuff came out. There was not a shred of evidence behind any of it. Right. And it ends up on the front page of the New York Times without doing any real investigative journalism or questioning the administration's claims. It could be, number one, I think they tend to be harder on Democrats.
Why?
Because maybe, this is all speculation, right? And every one of them is different. But I think some of them, they wouldn't be in journalism if they were real, for the most part, if they were real redneck conservatives. And I think they feel they have to make sure that their biases, some of them at least, that their even moderate biases are not showing. So they have to try harder to be critical.
So they're overcompensating?
Yeah, yeah. And I also think in some cases they felt that they got burned and embarrassed by their puppy love under George Bush, and they had to prove that, no, we're really, you know, objective and independent, and we can be tough when we have to, and that happened to be Barack Obama. But now today, any shred of truth coming out of the White House today has just been, I mean, that doesn't exist. This is just a White House full of lies, and it's tough for me even to go to the briefings today because you don't learn anything. There's no respect for the press at all, and it's just hostile and it's antagonistic, and it's just a parade of lies from the president, from the press secretary, from the chief of staff, from anybody who talks for this administration. So how do you deal with that? I think the way people deal with it and the way people are dealing with it is that we're seeing some of the best investigative reporting in this country that we've seen since the days of Watergate. I mean, the New York Times, the Washington Post are really doing great, great work, I believe. And so are some of the networks.
It's interesting to me that there is such a double standard in this country of the kind that we're talking about. And maybe it does have to do with, at least in the past, the press overcompensating for what might be perceived as a liberal bias, although that's a long conversation in itself. But you just, I mean, you look at the world we're living in and try to imagine that if Obama had not lived with his wife, if he had not spent any time with his young son, if he'd had lawsuits against him for sexual harassment, whatever, if he'd had alleged affairs with porn stars and so on and so on, he wouldn't have gotten away with any of that. And yet Donald Trump does, and others of his ilk do. I mean, the very people who were going after Bill Clinton, as you write about, for the affair with Monica Lewinsky, were themselves having affairs that never really came out, or even when they did, were just sort of brushed off. It's crazy, and nobody's really talking about the fact that there is such an intense double standard.
It is crazy. You cannot explain it, cannot understand it. We have a little rule on our show, on my show, that we have stopped asking the question about what if this had been Barack Obama, because
right.
It is so maddening. But let me just for a second play it. Can you imagine if Barack Obama had paid a porn star $130,000 not to talk about an affair 11 days before the election? I mean, the impeachment hearings would have started so fast your head would be spinning, right? And these people just look the other way. It is just monumentally corrupt and insane. And so I think you have to kind of sort of just keep barging on. But I just have a feeling that at some point, Mary Charlotte, this is all going to catch up with Donald Trump. If not the sexual stuff, which in the long run is less important, the financial stuff. And I think there's still an awful lot there, and that Robert Mueller is hot on the trail of financial conflicts, if not illegalities, in terms of Donald Trump and his dealings with the Russians before he became president, which is influencing the way he's dealing with Russia as president.
And all that remains to be seen. But in the meantime, I don't think it's just that the Republicans and their base are turning the other way. It's that the Democrats themselves are not really jumping on it. I mean, they're also letting this person get away with things, as they have done in Republican administrations in the past. They haven't succeeded. Democrats have not succeeded on getting a handle on voter suppression, on money in politics, on the surveillance state, on unions, on immigration, on gun safety, on even balancing the military budget against other priorities. All these things that they supposedly stood for, they've rarely gotten their messaging right. I mean, you talked about the list of words that was, you know, that Republicans said, use these words for, when you talk about Republicans, use these bad words when you talk about Democrats. Democrats seem to never really have done that themselves or taken the upper hand in the language about politics in this country, even as they are, certainly as you write about, the only ones who actually had any kind of guiding principles.
Well, I would say this. First of all, I agree in terms of messaging. Republicans run circles around the Democrats. But in terms of real raw power and the issues that you mentioned, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the Democrats are on one side of those issues and the Republicans are on the other side. And Democrats have raised these issues. They have fought for these issues. But in terms of pure, raw political power today, the Republicans have it. You know, look what they did with those tax cuts at the end of the year. They knew they weren't going to get any Democratic votes. So they just rewrote the rules and did it with where they only needed 51 votes. And then they got Mike Pence. And even if they couldn't get 51 Republicans. So, I mean, it's in terms of raw power to force this extreme right Republican agenda, Democrats today, frankly, just don't have the power to stop it. And the Republicans are using that power, I think, to undo 50 years or more of progress that we've made in this country under Republican and Democratic presidents on every front. And it's going to take us decades to recover and turn it back around.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is how Democrats let that happen. I mean, you write about, for example, how the conservative talk radio industry is so huge, and it has been for years. There has not really been any counterpart on the liberal or progressive side. That's one thing. But that big question of how they let it get to this point when, I'm going to quote you here, you said, the Republicans stand in the way of progress on any issues. They have no ideas. They're against everything, but they're for nothing, with the possible exception of tax cuts for the rich. And yet they keep winning. The Democrats have not been able to stand up to that. I find that just hard to really deeply understand.
It's hard to understand, and it's extremely frustrating. But I think several things happen. Democrats kind of, one, they took for granted, right, that they were in power and then would remain in power, and didn't work that hard in taking advantage of that opportunity. For example, I mean, the first 2 years Barack Obama was there, Democrats had control of both the House and the Senate. There was nothing done about gun safety during that time. There was nothing done about climate change during that time. There was nothing done about immigration reform. There was nothing done about infrastructure. The one thing that they spent all their time on was the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, which, as I point out, I think is a half-assed solution at best. Leaves the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies in charge and leaves 30 million Americans without health care. So Democrats missed an opportunity. And then another thing that was going on during that time is, under Barack Obama, the Senate entirely flipped, going from a Democratic majority to Republican majority. The House entirely flipped. And then, at the same time, Democrats didn't have their eye on the ball. We lost, during the 8 years of Barack Obama, 938 state legislative seats. We lost like 15 governorships. and 32 state legislative houses. So what happened was Republicans get all that power and they use it to draw new district lines, which mean that there are Republicans today elected whom you're never going to get out of office unless you change the district lines. And then to top it off, Democrats, I believe, nominated the wrong candidate in 2016 in Hillary Clinton, and that resulted in Donald Trump getting the White House. So in many ways, Democrats just dropped the ball politically. Now, I hope they're doing a little better job in 2018, but they had the power and they blew it, and they didn't use it when they had it.
What do you see shifting? I mean, you were a supporter of Bernie Sanders. He lost the primary. Then a lot of Bernie supporters declined to vote at all.
By the way, I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't know that you could blame Hillary's loss on I wouldn't blame Hillary's loss on Bernie Sanders voters not voting.
I'm not blaming her loss on that, but there were those people, Bernie or bust, who weren't going to vote for anybody else. I'm not saying that swayed the election.
I don't think there were that many, but certainly Bernie himself, his message was very, very clear.
Right.
You got to vote for Hillary Clinton. You cannot vote for Donald Trump, and you have to vote.
Right.
But not all of his followers followed that. I'd give you that point. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. Yeah. But in any case, there is an apparent groundswell especially on local and state levels, of people running for office and getting involved. It's reported on to some extent. It certainly isn't as well covered in the media, in the national media, as one would hope. But what are you seeing? Like, what is your hope for American politics? And what are you seeing happening right now?
I'll tell you, I am very, if I sounded too pessimistic a few minutes ago, I am very pumped up and very excited about what I see happening today on a couple of fronts. There is more excitement about politics and change than I've seen. And a lot of that is due and thanks to Bernie Sanders getting people involved, than I've seen, more excitement than I've seen since the anti-war protests that we talked about a little while ago. And it's mainly coming from young people, and it is active on many fronts. It's the Black Lives Matter movement. It's the Me Too movement. It's the Parkland March for Our Lives movement. It's the Women's March here. It is popping up on many fronts, and the result of it is more people than ever before running for Congress, running for state legislature, running for city council, and these are young people, and they're women, and they're people of color. Emily's List alone is training 31,000 women this year to run for public office, which is incredible. And so there's no doubt the energy, the momentum, the passion is on the Democratic side at every level. And I think that's really going to make a difference this year in 2018 at the state level, at the city council level, at the congressional level, and maybe even the Senate. I'm not saying there's a blue wave yet, but I think there's some makings of a blue wave. For example, if you look, since Donald Trump took office, there have been 39 state legislative seats, Trump districts, that have flipped from red to blue. And one thing we're seeing is that Democrats are fielding candidates in every one of these districts. Just recently, we had the special election in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania 18. For the last two times, the Democrats didn't even have a candidate running because it was such a heavy Republican district. This year, they come up with Connor Lamb, and they win it. So there's a little tension still about whether we should be running more progressive candidates, which I believe, or more moderate candidates. But, you know, the real answer to that is you run the candidate that fits the district. You can't run a Bernie Sanders kind of progressive like I am in every district in the country. It wouldn't work. But you could run a Connor Lamb kind of candidate in some of those districts and win them. So I think it's very, very exciting what we're seeing today. It makes me very hopeful that by the end of this year, we'll have at least the House, if not the Senate, maybe even the Senate, and get some of those state legislatures back and be in a stronger position to really get this country back on track in 2020. If Robert Mueller doesn't do it for us between now and then.
Bill Press is the host of The Bill Press Show, which is online at billpressshow.com. He's the author of several books. His new one is Bill Press From the Left, A Life in the Crossfire. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Friday, the 6th of April at 6:30 in the evening here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been so great. Sorry you've come to the end of it, but we'll see you all in Santa Fe on Friday at Collected Works.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.